Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. I'm pleased to introduce a very good friend of mine, and that is Ro Rahini. She is a brilliant medical student who's been working with me for the last 2 weeks. And I remember an old Bill Cosby sketch where Bill Cosby is a little boy getting his tonsils out, and he points to someone. He says, "Hey, you, almost a doctor." In the hospital. So hello, almost a doctor. Very soon, the 24-hour count is happening, right?
Thank you so much for having me. As you already pointed out, home stretch, I'm 24 hours away from being done.
And you'll have an MD, bright and shiny.
Yes, I will.
And then, of course, another year of hard labor before you actually have a license, but we'll be getting into medical education, probably into the weeds. But first, I want to give Ro a chance to tell us a little bit about her background. I think it's very instructive and interesting, and I hope you will as well.
Well, thank you. I am, full disclosure, my name is Roshan. I go by Ro generally. I prefer both. But I'm a first-generation Muslim American woman who is born to refugee parents from Afghanistan. So my parents left Afghanistan separately. My father in the late 70s, my mom in the early 80s escaped the Soviet invasion and then came to the U.S., jumped around, and then rekindled. They were neighbors in Afghanistan and remarried here and had me and my three brothers. But tomorrow, I will graduate from medical school, and I am the first one, to my knowledge, in my long line of lineage to pursue a doctoral degree. So that's very exciting for me and my family. But that's a little bit about me.
Well, I think what's important to emphasize is there's a lot of generational privilege and cultural privilege that comes with having academically sophisticated parents or grandparents, not just connections, but also just advice. Mm. And in your case, you had to find your advice outside of your home because neither of your parents got very far with their education.
Yeah, that is actually a common theme in my narrative, actually. Yes, true. So my mother probably, in American terms, has the education of maybe a third or a fourth grader. And my father, although he did finish a high school program here in the United States, he was actually diagnosed with dyslexia, and his parents didn't know that in Afghanistan. So he didn't really get the resources that he needed to be successful. And so that's kind of always, unfortunately, dampened their ability to be able to help me and my siblings academically. But I will say that I do have to credit so much of my success and my path in school to my parents, just because there are so many other women in my position and from my background that don't get to pursue the opportunities that I did. Even though my mother did not know how to speak English very well, she was the one who would wake up leave the house three separate times to make sure I made it in time to leadership and my brother made it in time for his activity and my other brother made it in time for his sports game. So she was like the best mom ever. And I think my dad, too, was just so motivating and just kind of always pushed us in the direction of academics they wanted better for us. They came here ultimately to give us the American dream, but they just didn't know how to give it to us. So the best that they could do is kind of be our cheerleaders on the side. And I'm proud to say that me and my three brothers have all finished university level degrees, and my brother's successfully working in like accounting and tech and all these other things. But if it really wasn't for the guidance of our parents, although maybe superficially not able to help us in the academic realm, if it really wasn't for their motivation and guidance and their pouring of energy into us, I don't think we would really be where we are today. So shout out to parents.
Shout out to parents. I think when you talk about this, my mind goes to, of course, Afghanistan and the just the many promising women whose education was just terminated in the last few years, and the enormous loss of human capital that happens when women are not given an education. Mm-hmm. There's so much data from all countries all over the world that if you educate the women, you you improve the society, you improve the ability of the families to rise, you improve the nutrition. Mm. There's just so many things that happen. And I know that in your household, you shared with me that you have a lot of aunts and other family members who are kind of in a similar position. You're a bit of an odd duck in the family when it comes to that. But I know that you have their respect.
Yeah, yeah. So I think I am fortunate in the sense that I had some family members who came here young and maybe tried to pursue school and did, and they did a great job at it. But there's like this whole other ball game when you're going into like a graduate level program. And kind of going back to touch on the whole situation in Afghanistan, there's also this like underlying guilt as being an Afghan woman who lives in the United States, is able to dress freely however I want to. I choose to wear a headscarf as a practicing Muslim, is able to get a fabulous education, is able to enter the workforce. And so there's something so liberating about that. But at the same time, there is this deep sense of guilt because why me? You know? And so that's one thing that I often kind of go back and think of. But kind of going back to my aunts and my family and my cousins, I mean, I just come from such a like complex background. But I do have to say, I do have family members who decided to get married very young, decided to have children young. That was not the path that I took. And it was a more common path, a more traditional path in our family. But my grandfather, actually both sides, maternal and paternal, were very pro-education. And I think that is something that kind of followed a lot of the refugees from Afghanistan. When Afghanistan was broken up and all these refugees were sent to Pakistan and Germany and Afghanistan, or excuse me, America and all these different countries, the ones that ended up in the U.S., I feel, really did try to push their children towards that American dream. I think a lot of them had kind of checked out and thought it wouldn't be something possible for them, but something that would be attainable for their children. And so I do see a lot of my cousins now who are going to universities and are getting pushed by their parents to become doctors and lawyers and engineers and whatever have you.
So tell us a little bit more about your path to getting into medical school. I know we have a number of people listening who have ambitions in that direction. So let's start with just your journey, please.
Sure. So, I mean, okay. So one thing I will say is backtracking. One thing that also does maybe set me apart a little bit from my family is a lot of my family members who did come over from Afghanistan or the ones that grew up here in the same age demographic as me went into entrepreneurship. And so they went into starting businesses and food products and restaurants and et cetera. And so that was one realm. I, for some reason, was never really entrepreneurial, or at least I haven't been yet. And so I was always kind of more fascinated with the STEM fields. Everything chemistry, biology, physiology related just spoke to me. And a lot of my direction towards medicine actually starts when I was a child, just going to the hospitals with my parents and being a translator. I mean, my mother did not speak English at least not well enough to have a medical conversation for the most part. And then my grandparents did not speak a lick of English for communication purposes. And so I'd go to these visits and these, even when they'd get admitted to the hospital, I'd go to the hospital with them and I'd talk to the doctors and I'd translate back and forth. And I just remember even doing this as a kid. Mm-hmm. But one thing that really sat with me was my mom's family medicine physician. So this was out of a community hospital in the East Bay. And I just remember that she was a woman. The female physician would walk in and how it would just, my mom's whole entire demeanor would just change. Like her shoulders would relax a little bit. She just felt at ease. It almost was like this physician had like a placebo effect on her with just her sheer presence. And I just knew that I wanted to elicit that type of change in someone's life. And it was positive change. It was without even, let alone without even opening her mouth or touching my mom or anything or reassuring, prescribing. It was just her sheer presence. That's the type of connection she had built with my mother, who was from a war-torn country and maybe didn't have the best relationship with the healthcare system here. And so that is kind of like what's guided me towards medicine.
I think you speak to the lived experience of immigrants and people from immigrant families all over the world, particularly with respect to the translation. Now, of course, in the last few years, technology has allowed us to technology and legislation, but really the legislation couldn't make us do it until the technology was there. Mm-hmm. Now we have good translation services in most hospital settings. You can either have a phone or a tablet. Tablet's nicer because you can see the translator and it feels like less of a disembodied voice. Mm-hmm. But at least you have that disembodied voice. And you know, with the rate that AI is moving, that's probably a temporary position or business model, because we'll be able to get to the point where the translations will be very good and just come out of a person's mobile phone. Mm-hmm. But that idea of translating for the parents is something in the last year I've been interviewing lots of medical students. Mm-hmm. And that, as your first experience with medical services and feeling, well, for that matter, feeling a little bit powerful yourself, mm-hmm. as a child, mm-hmm. that you can actually help your parent, that's something to be really proud of. And I think it sets up a reinforcement in our minds that helping others feels good. I know that that's true for me, and I think it's true of most of the physicians mm-hmm. that I know.
I absolutely agree. And the time that I'm talking about is like the early 2000s, so you're absolutely right, Dr. Motika. The translation services at that time were not accessible for the most part. I mean, my family from Afghanistan, we speak a dialect of Farsi, Dari, which is like the northern part of Afghanistan for the most part. And at that time, all you could find were Persian Iranian translators. And so a lot of you lose about, I would say, I'm not exactly sure, but about 30, at least I do, I lose about 30% of the meaning of translation between the two different dialects. Mm. And so I was often used in these very sensitive situations. And yeah, there is a bit of a positive reinforcement feedback, right?
You picked up your medical vocabulary early too.
I did. So that was actually quite useful. And actually, my first job in medicine at all whatsoever, which was scribing, which is essentially this role where you're kind of a fly on the wall, dictating everything that's happening between doctor and patient to kind of take time off of charting for a doctor. It came because I was translating for my mom at a visit in the ER. And the emergency room physician said, "Hey, you're really good at communicating. You'd be great for this pilot program we're starting." And I was like one of the first like 12 scribes at that program.
How old were you then?
Actually, when they hired me, I was under 18. They didn't realize it because they said I kind of carried myself a little older. And it wasn't until HR was like, "Uh-oh, we have to wait until you're 18. And then a month after my 18th birthday, I started. So it was my first like really, truly real job ever. And it was it just so happened to be in the emergency room. And it was because I was translating for my mom. So, yeah.
So in high school, did you think you wanted to be a doctor, or were you just attracted to the sciences? And how did it work, the transition from high school to college for you?
So I think I actually decided I wanted to be a doctor in elementary school. I know that sounds kind of strange because like what elementary school student kind of knows what they want to do? But I recall my grandfather on my mom's side was hospitalized, and it was my spring break. And my mom asked me what I wanted to do. And of course, I was obsessed with my maternal grandparents. And so I wanted to spend the week with them, even though he was actually admitted at Stanford Hospital. And so I spent the whole entire week there sleeping on the cot with my grandmother. And I just remember being a kid and like looking out of my grandfather's room at like 2 a.m. and just seeing the hustle and bustle of like nurses buzzing in and out, a provider or a doctor behind the desk typing notes and talking to a nurse about a patient, documentation happening, medication being. And it was like 2 a.m. and I just love the livelihood of it. I just love the hustle and bustle and just looking out and saying, wow, this is something that is not only happening at all times of the day, but you're helping people along the way. And I just remember being fascinated by that. And so that, coupled with my experiences with my actual primary care physician and my family's family medicine doctor growing up, is really one of the main reasons I'm here today. And then obviously the parents, you have to become something. And so it should be. And Southeast Asian parents oftentimes say you have to either become a doctor, a lawyer, or an engineer. And so my parents also pushing me in that direction helped.
Got it. So Let's move on to college. Where did you go?
I went to St. Mary's College in California, so just 15 miles east of Oakland.
Was it hard to get in?
So, yes and no. So, for me, I actually graduated high school a little bit early, about a year early. I learned late in high school that I did really well with homeschooling and that I picked up certain curriculum much faster than some of my peers, but some of the curriculum I obviously needed a little bit more time, just like, you know, lily padding, like any regular student. And so I was able to finish my senior year in about 3 months' time. And so I actually opted to go to community college. And so I went to community college for about a year and a half or so. And after about a year and a half, I got a scholarship to go to St. Mary's College. And so it was hard because I kind of felt like I was going into this whole situation blind without any guidance. I didn't know who to talk to about like applying to college other than guidance counselors, but I didn't really feel like the guidance counselors understood my situation. My siblings and I grew up very poor. And although as children, maybe we didn't really feel it because our parents worked very hard to make us not know we were. Once you got to college and you started seeing the prices of textbooks and it wasn't being provided by your high school anymore, you started to realize that, okay, you know what, financially, there's going to be an aspect here that I have to consider.
I think everybody who comes from a working class in a household confronts that sticker shock when they hit college. And for many of them, another thing that they encounter is the, you know, nobody looks like me. I don't, I don't identify with these people. People don't understand me. Mm-hmm. Did you struggle with that?
Oh my gosh, absolutely. Especially my first year at St. Mary's. So I went to community college at two pretty diverse community colleges. And then when I went to St. Mary's College, it was like a complete culture shock for me because I was the only woman wearing a headscarf. I think I was one of the only maybe handful of Muslims on campus, the other being my brother and my cousin. And so it was who came after me, actually. So it was hard for me to connect with my peers as not only a transfer student, but as somebody who just stood out like a sore thumb on a very small kind of small campus. So that was really hard for me. I actually, between, I guess, us and the listeners, I almost dropped out of St. Mary's my first year because I felt so uncomfortable. The one thing that was holding me back was the quality of education. I was in much smaller class sizes. I had gone to UC Davis and kind of experimented with their science classes and just felt really overwhelmed. I went into an organic chemistry class and there was like 200 students with their clickers. And I just felt like, okay, I'm so overwhelmed with the stimulation that's going on in the room that I can barely focus on what's in front of me. But then when I went to St. Mary's and had these 20 class size upper division science classes, it was amazing. I had one-on-one relationships with my professors. And then I ended up actually getting really close to the church. And I worked with them on how to make the campus more inclusive for interfaith purposes. And I think that is another big thing that kept me at St. Mary's, was working for the mission and ministry.
Interesting, because you, of course, it was a different religion, but it still had the common value of spirituality and faith. And that was how you bridged at least some of the gap between you and the rest of the people at St. Mary's. That's a really interesting thing. When you were, so at this point, you are solidly sure that you are a pre-med student, right?
Yeah.
So you selected those pre-med classes. Do you think, and obviously you were very smart, but do you think that there were missed opportunities in there that you would have done differently a second time around?
Absolutely. Actually, in college, my advisor pretty much told me because of my first and second years in college when I really did not know what I was doing. I don't think I actually knew what I was doing until maybe junior or senior year of college. My pre-med advisor told me blatantly I would never become a doctor. I didn't have the grades for it. And I didn't have bad grades. Like, I think I had like a 3.1 at this time, but of course you need like a 3.9, 3.8, 3.7 to get into the majority of the programs in the US. And so there was some heartbreak, but I do think there are a multitude of things that I would go back and tell myself to do differently. And a lot of this just has to do with not having guidance. So I think the first thing I would obviously tell myself is to set my goal and to make sure it's my goal. At some points in my life, I kind of kept going back and forth of like, okay, is this really what I want to do? Or is this what I'm doing because my parents want me to do? But it didn't become apparent until I was in medical school. You could just clearly see who's there because they really want to be there and who's there just because, well, mom and dad told them to be there. And oftentimes the latter group doesn't survive. And if they do, they're not very happy.
Oh, because it's not, the career itself is not a good fit for them, and it is not an easy life.
Yes, absolutely. And you said this best the other day, you give up such a large portion of your life, oftentimes your 20s, which is arguably one of the funnest times of your lives.
Yeah, it's the time before you have kids and responsibilities, and you get to be, you know, playful and irresponsible and we won't go through the entire list of things that people do or don't do in their 20s, but it's harder to pull that off in your 30s and 40s.
Yeah, and there's also like this rite of passage of like figuring yourself out, but mm-hmm. as a medical student, you're like expected to figure yourself out, but also figure out people, but also figure out this very dense scientific pathophysiology. So it's like this juggling act, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, let me take a moment and remind you that you are listening to K-Squid 89.5, 89.7, 90.7. And we'd be happy to take your calls. This is Ask Dr. Dawn. And you would have the opportunity to also ask Roshan Rahini about her life and her advice for immigrants and children of immigrants who are seeking medical careers. And we're not just talking about medicine. I think I want to emphasize this advice is applicable to people who choose to be nurses or who want to be physician's assistants, people who are interested in maybe being radiology techs, because really the guidance is the same. And the coming from behind, so to speak, when you don't have that boost that a family that's already in medicine or a relative, I mean, personal anecdote just to break, I got into a medical school completely on nepotism on the basis of the fact that my stepfather's brother was a major donor. Mm. I didn't particularly want to go to that medical school. Mm-hmm. But they gave me an acceptance without an interview. And that is the kind of privilege mm-hmm. that, you know, a working class girl from L.A. gets just because of who her mom happened, you know, who her mom happened to marry. Mm-hmm. And that isn't right, just, or fair. Mm-hmm. But I didn't go to that school, so so I can tell that story with and still believe that I made my own way through it.
Yeah.
The point that I wanted to make here is let's talk about getting to know who you are, because that was that's, as you said, a big part of being successful as a student, learning how you learn. And so let's talk about that, because you got much better in college after you learned how you learn.
Yes.
So how did you learn how you learn, and how do you learn?
Yeah. So one of the pieces of advice that I was going to get is to, before you study anything, study yourself. You have to figure out, A, what direction you want to go into, and that's something I'll talk about. And B, you also have to figure out how you're going to get to that position, but also through what means. So, and what I mean by that is, what type of learner are you? You know, purely for this conversation, because we're talking about academics and school and graduate programs, knowing what type of learner you are and what works for you is something that changed me as a student substantially. I did not know in high school, or maybe I started to kind of begin to figure it out in high school and college, but it wasn't until I truly got to medical school that I learned the type of learner that I was. And so what I mean by that is I realized through my career that I was a kinesthetic and a visual learner.
please tell us what kinesthetic means.
Yeah, so a kinesthetic learner is somebody who learns through tangible touch, through working with models, through, I guess this could arguably also segue into being a visual learner, but drawing pictures. I know that in medical school, I was like glued to my iPad and my Apple Pencil because I love to draw models and to really just lay things out to me. So in classes or in learning situations where I was just expected to sit somewhere and just digest a bunch of information that was thrown at me, which traditional schooling oftentimes does, I wasn't performing as well because I wasn't given the tools or resources to succeed, and I didn't know what tools I even needed to begin with. So I think it's important to realize the type of learner you are before you enter this path, because it makes things so much easier. Oh gosh, my academics just skyrocketed once I figured it out. I think I really came to the conclusion my junior year in college, and by that point it just felt a little late. You know, for medical school in the US, it's so competitive and it's so hard to get in, and I truly credit everyone who does. But for me, because I didn't really have the guidance, I also was working three different jobs in college to make ends meet and to be able to stay in college despite having a scholarship. It just felt like I, A, had no guidance, and B, at times my world was falling apart because I didn't have the guidance. And so one of the things that I would love to do through this segment or and in my future advocacy is help individuals in my position who also don't maybe have that beacon of guidance and kind of become that compass for them. Not necessarily giving them the exact answers, but giving them a general direction of A, it's going to be okay. B, you'll end up where you're supposed to. And C, these are some of the things that'll make it easier along the way. And so alongside knowing and learning the type of learner that I was and figuring out what worked for me, I also kind of tapped into learning more about my personality. And so one thing that I like to suggest, especially in younger kiddos who are maybe in middle school and high school and are always confused,
they don't feel a calling.
Yes.
That's the best way to put it.
Yes. Actually, I like that more. So in younger kiddos who haven't heard their calling yet, I oftentimes get questions of like, well, how did you know you wanted to do this? Or how did you figure it out? And I think it was just that I got my calling very early in life. But one thing I like to suggest to them, and this is not to put any sort of complex in their heads, but to take a personality test. One that I really like is, and one that I have actually used in an academic and in a work environment, is the Myers-Briggs assessment. So it's essentially this personality test. I think it has about like 70 something questions. It takes maybe 10 to 20 minutes. And it gives you one of 16 personalities that you can fall into. And it just gives you an awesome analysis.
I took that a long time ago, and I have completely forgotten what my actual letters were. But the categories, there are four categories, and you are taking a series of questions that rate you as either being high in extroversion or high in introversion, high in sensing or high in intuition, high in thinking or high in feeling, high in judging, and high in perceiving. And so these are designated by the first letter, and then you end up with all of these different types, like an ESFP, which would be an extroverted, sensing, feeling, perceiving person. I'm looking here at something I dug up. It's a pretty good description of it. It comes from a company that does actually contribute often to the NPR programming, and that's indeed.com. It contributes to a lot of the podcasts I listen to. And so I thought that their analysis was very good because they basically came up with the personality types, as we've said, and then talked about what types of settings, you know, if you are an INFG, for example, you are perhaps more suited to be a librarian, a psychologist, a scientist, a writer, or a counselor. Mm. And they give them all sorts of nicknames, which we won't bother to go into. How did you experience yourself in the Myers-Briggs, and how did it help you in your life?
Yeah. So, okay. So, flashing forward from after college, I took a role at UCSF as a clinical research coordinator. And after some time, months there, I was fortunate enough to receive a promotion and I got bumped into a supervisor role. So I was supervising these phase one clinical trials. And one of the things that I noticed is my connection with those around me very differently. So there were certain individuals at that time. I probably had about 13 people who I was overseeing, and then another 10 people who were working alongside me. And my connection with each individual varied, obviously, as they do. But I felt like I was getting through to maybe about 60% of my colleagues, but the other 40%, there was just like some kind of wall. And it felt like our group was just very fragmented. And so like any supervisor, I did what any supervisor should do in the situation, and I planned a murder mystery dinner.
Oh yeah, that's the plan. That's the solution to everything.
It's always a good murder mystery dinner. Literally solves anything. And so we actually set up a whole retreat, my leadership team and I, for the group to go away to the river, get a few days together, recenter, and just kind of become more of like a fluid unit. And so one thing that I actually had everybody around me do is take the Myers-Briggs assessment. And so after I got everyone's results and had them send it to me, I actually made this bar graph to kind of show like, oh, this is how many INFJs we have. This is how many ENFPs we have, to kind of show like what our group consisted of. And then I also talked about what each group likes. One thing that was really important for me as a supervisor at the time is certain groups do not like public praise. And so when I thought that I was giving everybody credit and was giving them positive reinforcement, saying, hey, so-and-so, great job with what you did at the presentation the other day, I noticed it was actually making certain individuals uncomfortable. And then I was able to learn more about my human connection with them through these personality tests, that, you know, they like private praise more. They like feedback in a private setting. Certain individuals like feedback in a public setting. And so it allowed me to learn more about my colleagues, and across the board, all of my attendees for the actual retreat said the same thing. They felt like they understood each other a lot more after the retreat. And funny enough, after the retreat happened, we had a couple of physicians who came with us. One of them was working on with a residency, was I believe maybe a residency director for the program at the time. And she actually asked us for our template because they wanted to implement this amongst the new incoming resident class to help them as like an icebreaker and to get to know each other and to just understand communication. And I will say, and I don't want to take all the credit, but I will. After that retreat, the unit was different. I mean, I went off to medical school just a few months after that, but I felt good leaving the unit because everybody was getting along. It was fluid. We were all working together. And there was just like a sense of understanding. And so one thing I will preface say in the situation, especially when I'm saying, oh, take it in high school or middle school to kind of figure out what your personality type is like, you don't have to have your life figured out, but it's good to have some general direction of maybe what your personality gravitates towards.
Right. And I think I'll just take that a step further and say, in taking it in medical school, what Indeed has done here is, you know, more satellite view in terms of careers. Mm. I actually think that in terms of medical subspecialties, if I were to think about which of these skills, first of all, physician, of course, has a couple of settings, but depending on whether you are the introverted, the extroverted physician, for example, the amount of the judging versus perceiving, that's really going to make a difference in which subspecialty you're going to find yourself. And so in medical school, if you take this, you can maybe think about, well, I really am kind of an introvert. Mm-hmm. So radiology, where I don't have to, or pathology maybe, or things where I wouldn't say anesthesiology so much, although a great deal of your time you're spending with people who are unconscious and don't have to talk to them. But I do think that personality fit, and I did see there are certain people that you just knew they were going to surgical subspecialty mm-hmm. and ortho. You know, mm-hmm. it's like you could pick the orthopedists out a mile away.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they were all jocks and they all had big hands and they mm-hmm. were kind of like, yeah, I don't care about the fluff. Just let's get this done. You
yeah.
know?
Where's the drill?
Yeah. Where's the drill? Exactly. So I do believe that it probably works for any individual mm-hmm. and it does give you a chance to find your tribe, mm-hmm. I think, is the way mm-hmm. that I would put it. When I encountered functional medicine, I'm a science geek. I love the detail, the deep dive, and I'll, you know, go read the methods section of things to decide whether I believe them or not. And I think in a sort of systems way, large feedback loops. It's just how I approach the world, and let's call it an ecosystem approach to any situation. What's the ecosystem? You know, where are the predators? Where's the prey? Where's the energy gradients? Where are the resources? You know, and I found my tribe. That's how the functional medicine people think, and that's why this approach was such a good fit for me. And so, first of all, I think that happiness is finding your tribe and finding your place and finding something that is personally rewarding. Mm-hmm. I can't say strongly enough how I would tell my children, if I had any, to go into medicine, but I would give them a lot of advice about how to place themselves and where to place themselves, because mm-hmm. there's a lot of corporations having moved so thoroughly into medicine. You really have to figure out a way to not be replaceable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And once you can figure out how to not to be replaceable, and then, like you did as a very good supervisor, they don't want you to go. They want you to stay.
Yeah. And adding a little bit to this, one of the best pieces of advice I ever got in life was actually from the attending I was working underneath. She was just a beautiful soul. She was a Swedish woman. Her name was Dr. Munster. She was a credible physician, still is. And she told me one day in her office, she said, "Ro, the personality that you have is an awesome one, but just the way that life works, not everyone's going to like you, and that's okay. But what isn't okay is just leaving it at that." And so with the personality tests, it's kind of like, yes, I agree, we need to find our tribes. But sometimes, like in this case of residency, your tribe is kind of already picked for you.
Yes.
And you have to figure out how to work with them. And part of that is a big part of that is understanding them. And so for me, understanding the human connection I have with those around me is important. And so I am a big advocate of taking these tests. They're kind of fun. Everyone kind of gets into them. And then, you know, you don't have to internalize them deeply, but it's good to know how to communicate with each other and to understand one another.
Okay, I totally agree. So let's turn it back to a little bit about your schooling. You didn't get into an American mm-hmm. medical school. So mm-hmm. you went to school, you sort of did and you sort of didn't. Why don't you tell that part of the story?
Yeah. So around the time that I was working at UCSF, I had kind of two choices. My choices were to stay back and do a post-bac degree, which oftentimes they cost around $30,000 or $40,000.
Yeah, let's talk about what a post-bac is. These didn't exist when I trained.
So a post-bac is a post-bachelor degree. It's not necessarily a master's degree, but it's not just taking classes. Usually they're structured programs that help you. They're for people who do late career changes or maybe individuals who didn't perform as well in undergrad. But you can either A, go through a structured program through like UC Berkeley Extension or East Bay and Hayward and multiple other programs and get an actual, I guess, certificate. Or what you can do is just opt to take classes on your own, either through a community college or through like extension universities.
And these would be what kind of courses?
So in my case, it would be more pre-med classes. So they were like upper division science courses like biochemistry, genetics, physiology, anatomy with lab and cadaver, etc. So my options were to either take those classes, and if you do choose to take individual classes, just a few years ago, about 7 years ago when I was working, they're around $1,000 to $1,300 a class, or you could go to an actual program for around $30,000, $40,000. And that just was not...
For a year. Yeah,
and
not cheap.
No. And they were actually also oftentimes part-time as well. So for me, it just was not feasible. I applied one time to American medical schools and just got rejected completely. And then the second year, I got waitlisted at a DO school. And so in the back of my mind, I just didn't know if it was feasible. I was pretty low down on the waiting list. I also at this time applied to multiple Caribbean medical programs. And I actually heard back from one almost instantly, just maybe a week later. And I had my interview the week after that. So this is all happening within
very, very fast, very rapidly.
Yeah. And so for somebody who's been waiting for years to kind of start this, it's enticing to be sought after so quickly. And after my interview, they emailed me with an acceptance, and they also gave me a opportunity scholarship. So I actually got into multiple programs in the Caribbean, but only one of them actually offered me aid and a scholarship. And so that was the one that I chose.
And what is an opportunity scholarship? Is that because you were from an underrepresented in medicine group?
Yes. And I performed well academically, and also more so than my GPA, it was my MCAT score, which mm-hmm. is the entrance exam for medical school. I performed pretty well on it. And so it was kind of like this, you had good merits despite having not so many opportunities in life. So here's some money for compensation. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've been looking into, it's actually a school in Utah. I think it's, I'm not sure which one it is, but it's a medical school. Mm-hmm. And they've worked over the last 5 years, I think, to increase their diversity. And they ended up settling on giving people resilience points for the sorts of things we're talking about. First person in a family to attend college.
Wow.
Coming from an underrepresented group, immigrant family, not that sort of privilege that I talked about having as a white woman with mm-hmm. a family connection mm-hmm. and very good MCATs, I might add. But the point is that I thought it's a way to acknowledge outside of race mm-hmm. and outside of ethnicity, because you can be... you can fit that profile and be from West Virginia.
Right.
And be, you know, sunburny white person mm-hmm. and still have come from a background where you are underrepresented in medicine in terms of your background and your upbringing. And you would have a different way of relating to people who were poor from whatever setting. And that, I think, is really what we're after, is we're after taking medicine away from being this elite, you know, white male profession. And mm-hmm. women have made substantial inroads in the last 30 years. And I think that's only helped the profession in terms of its humanity, although it's also allowed us to be systematically abused by the corporations.
A podcast for another day.
I don't keep my opinions to myself, but I also try not to take an entire show to dedicate them to. They're asides. So getting back to your experience with your school, and I don't know if we can name them or not, so let's not. Let's mm-hmm. just say it was a medical school in the Caribbean. How does that work?
Yeah.
Now, you do your... do you do all of your training in the Caribbean, or do you come back for your clinical years?
Yeah, Caribbean medical students are actually quite a unique enigma, if you will. We train...
Unicorns.
Yes, unicorns. I love the way you say that. So we do... So the way that medical school works is the first 2 years, which are quote-unquote your basic sciences, is your book work, you're taking exams and classes. And then your last 2 years, which are your clinical sciences, is when you're rotating around in different hospitals and doing different things like neurology, cardiology, nephrology, etc.
And they start letting you touch patients and
yes.
leave you alone in the room to take a history.
Yes.
Maybe even sew someone up if you get lucky.
Yes. Yes, exactly. It's the fun years. And so for the Caribbean medical schools, you can do 2 years in the Caribbean islands. Or some schools also allow you to go to the UK, and then you actually come back to the US for your clinical sciences, and you rotate with American medical students. So you're in this weird crux of, you're not necessarily an international medical graduate who, let's just say, came from Senegal, but you're also not an American medical student who went to Stanford or Harvard or UCSF or whatever have you. You are kind of like in this weird situation where you do face some bias because you are judged for not getting into an American medical school, but you also have opportunities that international medical students wouldn't necessarily have, like taking your boards exams at the same time as American medical students and being able to rotate in American hospitals and learn the American medical system, mm-hmm. which oftentimes international medical students have a disadvantage.
It's very challenging.
Yeah. So you integrate into this, you're able to integrate back into the American system in your third and fourth year, despite being away. My situation was a little different because I went to medical school during the COVID pandemic. And so I spent a whole year pretty much, I got evacuated from the island when I first went there about an hour and a half, a month and a half afterwards, and I ended up doing everything on Zoom.
Well, let's hope that we don't move to all Zoom medical education. I think that there's so much to be gained from hands-on and in-person, and I think I feel bad for the people whose educations were truncated mm-hmm. in that way, mm-hmm. but they'll bounce back. If there's anything that COVID taught us, it's that we can survive and we can be resilient in the face of adversity. And that's Absolutely. A life lesson that we'll all carry with us. Absolutely. I also am really curious about whether it changes the number of people who go into the surgical specialties or whether there's a long-term effect of being part of the COVID generation. Have there been any forums or anything you've seen on your groups about that? Any trend lines emerging there?
If students are applying to certain specialties after COVID, or if Caribbean yeah. students don't get opportunities, in
more across across the board, mm. the COVID generation, let's call it.
Yeah. So one trend that I have seen, and I think the entirety of medical community has seen, is that since the COVID pandemic, and especially in the last few years, a lot of primary care roles have gone unfilled. So when medical students finish in their fourth year, they go into something called the MATCH, which basically pairs them into a residency program. And it's like this long process. But a lot of residency programs in family medicine, internal medicine, emergency room medicine are actually going unfilled. And what that means is that there's a lot more medical students than there are residency positions. So when residency positions are not being filled by the sheer vast amount of medical students, there's some sort of dysbiosis there. And it seems like there's some sort of negative relation or negative feedback with the primary care realm, being internal medicine, family, and emergency room mm-hmm. since the COVID pandemic and individuals choosing that specialty. I feel like it has a lot to do with maybe burnout and lifestyle rates, but I'm not exactly sure about the actual metrics.
Well, it'll be intriguing to follow that over the next few years mm-hmm. and see if that, because I can think of another variable, which is just reimbursement.
Right.
And the, you know, the sheer amount of nonsense that people in the front-facing primary specialties, mm-hmm. not hospital-employed, are being stuck with right now. Mm-hmm. There's lots of laws and legislation, prior authorization, anti-prior authorization legislation is currently making its way through California, for example. Mm-hmm. And a prior authorization, folks, if you haven't heard about that, is before you can, although you have insurance and this is a covered thing, before you can have it, it can't just be ordered by the doctor. The doctor has to go through a review process. And these review processes are sometimes really enormously time-consuming, and they're not reimbursed. So time and hours of my life are what I have to sell. Mm. And so when doctors are getting historically lower wages than, say, the surgical specialties, and at the same time they're working effectively off the clock for a couple of hours a day just to get their patients what they need mm. and get their notes written, that doesn't look like a particularly doesn't look like a particularly appetizing career. Mm. You have to go into it understanding that there is more than one kind of compensation. But that's just my that's my viewpoint. And
it's interesting to hear, as somebody who has been a primary care advocate for so many years. But yeah, it's interesting to hear from an attending's perspective.
Well, it'll be there's a lot more to talk about. I think we've got just checking for emails, and we don't have one. So let's take the last 5 minutes that we've got, and have you try to boil it down to middle school, high school, college, thinking about a medical career. What are my moves? You've crowdsourced that from your colleagues.
Right.
What are the good moves in middle school?
So the first thing that I'll say, and I think this is maybe one of the most important points that I can make, especially being somebody from an underserved, underprivileged background, is I think the thing that has helped me the most along the way is a mentorship. And I'm talking about finding a mentor who has similar upbringing and path in life as you, just because they're going to understand a lot more. And oftentimes people who have made it in the position that you want to be in and has faced the same adversity as you want to help you because they understand what it takes. Mm-hmm. I foresee myself doing mentorship in the future, just because I know the grueling path. And also these connections are truly what do help you in the future. And then in addition to that, keeping a supportive and also enriching environment. I mean, my friends always joke, they're like, we went through medical school with you. On Monday, when I found out my match, they all kind of texted me like, oh my gosh, we all matched. It feels like we're all matching, just because they've gone through the qualms and the emotional roller coaster of medical school with me. And there are times where I couldn't even take care of myself, and they stepped in and took care of me just purely out of love. And so I think I credit a lot of my success to having good mentors that have given me guidance along the way, which I connected with too late in life. So my advice in middle school and high school is really start solidifying good mentors who can A, stick with you, and B, give you help and propagate you in the direction that you want to go in, and B, to keep supporting and enriching environments, because I've seen how things can change in the blink of an eye because of the environment that you're in.
I think I wanted to bring it back around to the church again for just a moment, because that is if you are part of a faith community, that is a wonderful place to start looking for mentors and to reach out and ask for assistance. The local chamber of commerce, the local medical society, if it's a medical career, we're very interested in helping people. Most community colleges, and of course, UCSC has a great program that they reach out to STEM students in high school and bring them in and talk to them about it, give advice, and set up programs. We just finished our mentorship program. I shouldn't say our, but it's the collective. We have members in the County Medical Society who step forward every year and do things like teach people how to suture and just give them a real sense of what the life is like.
And even an added layer. So when you do get to medical school, one thing that I was asked about at almost every single one of my interviews for these residency programs was not necessarily the grades I got or whatever. It was actually a lot of the advocacy work I did at my local mosque. A lot of the connections happened at my local mosque. I was able to connect with other like-minded individuals and had some really great content to talk about during residency interviews. So it helped me.
Okay. So mentorship and cultivate supportive relationships.
Yes.
And keep them green, value them, work on them, invest in them, because they will invest back in you. Plus you're at the age, at that age where you have the chance to make lifelong friends and bonds that you can carry with you now that the distance between friends has collapsed so greatly by the existence of the internet and text messaging. Those are what you need to help you stay afloat, I would say.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, I want to thank you, Roshan Rahini, for coming and being with us and giving us the benefit of your wisdom and perspective. You've been listening to Ask Dr. Dawn. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.